Yeah, I mean, you can't force a dog to be into space either.
Well, sure you can. The Russians did.
Oh, poor Laika.
Still up there somewhere. It's going to be maybe a shorter show, right? Because you're kind of in the weeds.
The weather is over me. It's true.
The weather is over you. Yeah. All right. Well, it's still Tuesday, though. Right.
Yep. It's true. Tuesday.
Still Tuesday. So it's still on Taking Pictures. Episode 138. We might just be on Taking Fewer Pictures.
I like that. That was cute.
It's Tuesday. We're talking about photography like we do each and every week. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com. And with me, the sickly Bill Wadman.
I will prevail in the end.
Well, I hope so.
I got the plague from my niece and nephew. So
yeah, well, that happens.
The little kids, when they get together, they're like little Petri dishes. You know what I mean?
That's right.
It's true, though. It's not. It's funny until the point at which you realize that it's also true.
It's funny until you go, wait a minute, there's a tickle in my throat.
Yeah, exactly.
My head's a little stuck. Damn you, child.
Where is that? Yeah, exactly. Were all those kisses worth it? I don't know.
Nope.
Probably not.
Nope.
But we're here. We're gonna make the best of it.
Make the best of it.
So, Jeffrey, I have approximately $7 million.
Yeah,
burning
a hole in your pocket. Apparently, that's really the long and short of it. Yeah.
Okay. So we're really gonna talk about this?
Well, okay. I don't want to talk about if you're into photography at all, you probably know that. Peter Lick, photographer, reportedly sold a photograph for $6.5 million, making it the most expensive photograph in the world. And you know, whether you agree with it or not.
Wait, agree that it happened or agree that it was a good idea?
Well, either or, you know, was it a publicity thing? Did it happen? Maybe it didn't. Who knows? I don't know. But let's assume that it did.
Okay.
You can get bogged down in whether it was worth it, right?
Yes.
Whether it was worth it. Now,
you don't have to get bogged down. No, that's the answer.
I don't think it was worth it for a number of reasons. Number one, if you do a Google image search for Antelope Canyon.
Sure. Have you been?
I've not been there, no. But if you do a Google image search for Antelope Canyon, you're going to find on the homepage 60 or so photographs that are very similar to Lick's shot.
This is not original art, as it were.
No. If you go to 500 Pixels or Flickr, you will likely encounter similar results.
Right. Yeah.
So I think one of the big problems with it for me is that this is not, as much as he and his marketers want to argue, this is not a unique shot in the least.
No. What is the argument that because of the dust that's in the air at the time?
Who knows? Who knows? Okay. I'm just playing devil's advocate that you could spin this, your marketers could spin this, that the light was in exactly this position, the dust was in exactly this position. Okay, fine, whatever. But it's not a once-in-a-lifetime event. Any day that the sun is up, there's a chance for a similar shot to this.
Yeah. And let me tell you something. I have nice shots from Antelope Canyon and I'm terrible at this kind of stuff. So
exactly. Yeah. Okay. And I would argue that there are nicer shots out there of Antelope Canyon taken by people you've never heard of.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
That will never get $6.5 million. So, you know, I look at this and I go, okay, there's a guy with a tripod and a camera.
Isn't that how every good story starts?
Yeah, maybe, you know, but then you look at somebody like, let's say, Gregory Crudson, who spends a year or more sketching and planning and building and refining. And there are teams of people and there's all of this sort of effort and sweat and creative juice that goes into making a shot.
Yeah.
And they sell for nowhere near.
Well, they still sell for $100,000 or more.
$100,000 and $6.5 million is a pretty big gap.
Yeah, okay. But at the same
time, take his own work. Take Lick's own work. You can buy his very similar shots on his site for $4,500.
But just to play devil's advocate with what you just said, I mean, we are also giant fans of people who happen to have a camera in their hands when they see something and they take a picture and it's one of our favorite pictures. So it's not all the planning and the effort too.
Agreed. Right. Agreed. But what I'm saying is all that planning and effort for me contributes to a moment that exists once and once only.
Yeah. Yeah. There's very little unique about the pictures, what you're saying.
Right. To me, this picture is, it should be on a motivational poster, or it's something that you would find in a, you know, in a Sharper Image catalog highlighting a frame.
Right. So is this just a PR stunt?
I don't know. And the thing that I'm having the harder time with is there's an equality or a democracy of sorts in art, in that whatever that piece is, whether it's, you know, a Monet or a Picasso or a Chagall or whatever, we are all equal for that moment that we're standing in front of it, because we're all looking for some sort of meaning, some sort of connection, some sort of emotional response to that piece.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Yeah. Okay.
When
assuming it's sitting in a museum.
Okay. Yeah. Whatever it may be, it could be in a book too.
Sure.
But when something like this happens, that is so beyond the scale, it throws that balance off, and it causes us to question what we're looking at in a way that maybe it wouldn't have before.
Okay. Well, look. You obviously millions of people have seen this photograph since it's been in all these articles.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the equivalent of seeing it in a book? You know what I mean? You could say that whoever the buyer is just a sucker.
I would say
rich people have said stuff, have bought stupid stuff or spent tons of money on stuff for no good reason before.
Absolutely. I think this is a case of more money than sense.
I mean, this is certainly, look, there, you may disagree with it, but there's certain argument to be made for buying a Saul Leiter print right before he dies, or buying, if you have $100 million, a Monet or a Van Gogh or a Picasso, because you think it's going to be worth more later. That's a good investment.
There's understandable.
No way, there's no way that this photograph is a good investment.
No.
Right. So whoever bought it, if they actually bought it and it wasn't just some, you know, thing, is doing it for some other reason. You know, they're billionaire and
that's what I have to come back to, is that it is a case of more money than sense, because there's nothing unique about it.
Right.
It's not the only one. In fact, it's looks to be a black and white conversion of a color photo. Yep. So
the color one is better. You know,
even the color one is way oversaturated.
They're the typical stuff, but I don't think the black and white makes it any sexier. You know?
No. So is this a case of I can't even put my finger on it.
Well, maybe it's just as simple as some stupid rich guy bought some picture for way too much money.
Yeah, but does that mean that there was somebody else willing to pay $5 million and he just went, I'll go $6 million?
No, because maybe, I don't know.
You know, or could the guy have said, you know what, $6.5 million is way too much. I'll give you $3 million.
Well, it could be too. Did they say the size of the print that he wanted? That he got?
I did not read any size.
Either. So maybe Lick sells them at 30 by 40 inches, and this guy's like, I want one that's 60 by 100. And Lick said, well, that's going to be $6 million.
Yeah.
And the guy said, screw it, sure.
Yeah.
Where's your bank account, son? You know, like, we have no
idea. Is he a Texas oil baron?
Yeah. In my mind, he is, actually.
Did he drive up in a Cadillac with horns on the front?
It's either that or like Sheldon Adelson or some other fool.
Did Boss Hogg buy this picture?
Yes. He came into some money.
That's right. That's right. I hope the Duke boys don't steal it.
Well, and it's supposed to be one of three photographs for $10 million, right?
Right, right. That was the other thing. So he has... What, four of the top 20 most expensive?
These, in some ways, I see these as having a big asterisk next to them, you know. Let me ask you a question. There are some people who are making comments about this because this happened outside the Gerskys and the, you know, what's her name, who does the self-portraits?
Cindy Sherman.
Cindy Sherman. And those that are also on the top five list, or were up until a week ago.
Right.
Were all sold through reputable auction houses, blah, 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 etc.
Right.
Does that change it at all? In the same way that sort of like, oh, it's an unofficial record because it didn't happen at a sanctioned event. You know what I mean? Like, yes, this guy jumped 30 feet instead of, you know, 29 right, point, right. whatever it is, but it was during practice, so it doesn't count.
So it doesn't count. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's still, for me, it still comes back to, it's a bad photograph. It's not a, it's, there's nothing special about it.
Okay.
For me.
So why does that bother you? So some guy spent $10 million on it.
That part doesn't really bother me as much as the sort of repercussions of now people questioning the values of their own work and the values of existing work. So this is because we have this tendency to assume that more expensive is better, right?
Yeah.
One of the reasons that Hasselblad keeps selling Lunars.
Right.
If they had Sony's name on them, then they wouldn't sell for as much as they do. But because
they
have
wooden handles, Jeffrey.
That's true. That's true. So there is this tendency to ascribe value or worth based on a dollar amount. So does that mean that this Canyon photo, Ghost, is that what it's called? Ghost? I think it's called Ghost.
Apparition.
Phantom. Sorry, Phantom.
Whatever. Who cares?
Is a better, in quotes, big quotes, photograph than anything that Cindy Sherman has ever done, anything that Saul Leiter has ever done, anything that,
yeah,
that
I don't know that Cartier-Bresson. I don't know how many people actually would believe that. Do you think there's people who would say that?
I think that
people who have any knowledge of this industry, you think anybody would actually say that?
I don't know. Isn't that part of society? Is more expensive means better?
Yeah, for a lot of people, sure.
An Aston Martin is better than a Honda. You know, single loom Japanese denim is better than Levi Strauss.
Yeah, but we're in territory here where it's not about the materials or the quality of the workmanship. You know,
right. It's definitely caused some sort of ripples, right?
Well, it's caused a lot of. Oh my God, somebody sold a photograph for $7 million. And, you know, there's and front pages of photo blogs and stuff. You know, I don't think the New York Times cares all that much, you know.
Maybe not, but there are a couple of articles on The Guardian that
what was
made.
Okay, so that, right. Okay, so now we get into the whole, the argument of whether this is unreasonable because photography was never art in the first place stuff. Right.
And then you've got this Jonathan Jones article, Peter Lick's hollow, cliched and tasteless black and white shot of an Arizona canyon isn't art and proves that photography never will be.
Okay. you can't judge an entire art based upon one image.
That is correct.
That's correct. That's just asinine.
He had me up until the
first sentence.
Yeah. The end proves. I'm with you, Jonathan, until you get to and proves that.
Yeah.
Dot.
It's, you know, like for, okay. So somebody bought some crappy picture. That doesn't mean that art is not art or photography is not art. That's just stupid. And you know what? Is it sentimental? Yes. Is it cheesy? Yes. You know, but unfortunately, the market for art is not based necessarily upon what is wonderful and approved by the art historians, you know?
Right.
So some guy bought it. I think it's stupid, but I certainly don't think that it pushes out everything that you know, it's this whole, what does he say here? Google is full of great pictures of this awe-inspiring natural feature. So therefore, one person's picture of it is worthless.
Right.
That's also a stupid, he's setting up an argument that makes no sense.
Agreed.
I don't know, who is this guy anyway? Why are we listening to Jonathan Jones?
Jonathan Jones, because he writes for The Guardian, man. I liked Sean O'Hagan's response to it.
Yes.
He writes, imagine, if you will, the following scene. I pop into the National Gallery to view the 2014 BP National Portrait Award and look in bemusement at the exhibition, which is mostly comprised of rather old-fashioned paintings. It's an uninspiring show. A hodgepodge as are most exhibitions drawn from open submissions. Inexplicably enraged by this, I rush home and pen an article claiming that painting is dead and exactly. that it looks anachronistic, indeed stupid, on a gallery wall in the 21st century. Not only that, but that I then extrapolate that all painting is dull and stupid. Caravaggio, Rubens, Picasso, Hockney, Richter, the lot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly. So, it's a ridiculous argument.
So does this even
merit a conversation?
Yeah. Does it merit the conversation around it that has cropped up?
I think that in much the same, I think that a lot of the stuff that is around photography in general, when it comes to media, I mean, all the blogs that all of us obviously look at every once in a while, some of our listeners probably look at, a lot of photographers look at, they've got to put up 6, 8, 10 articles a day. You know, not all of them are going to be journalistic gold. Not all of them are going to be anything more than the crap that you find on Facebook, not just listicles of whatever it is, but also, you know, let's discuss something that's going to make half of you upset in both directions. You know,
so is this just link baity, you know, 10 things you can do to blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Yes, it is. And it makes no difference to the future of photography. None.
That was going to be another question.
To me, I don't see it making it. It's like, who cares? You know, one guy bought one thing for one price. Big deal. You know, if it made the whole market for photography suddenly double or triple in price for everybody, because suddenly photography was valuable because some guy spent $6.5 million on a picture. Well, then that's something, but it's not. You know, it's not suddenly going to make every photograph by everyone we like worth twice as much.
Yeah.
You know, this is a blip. This is 15 minutes of fame.
I just, listeners, if you get the chance, read this Sean O'Hagan article in the show notes, because I love how he takes him to task. Here are a few photographers off the top of my head whose work is art: Julia Margaret Cameron, Edward Steichen, William Eggleston, Nan Golden, Robert Frank, Stephen Shore, Deanne Arbus, Paul Graham, Hiroshi Sugimoto. Their work sings on the gallery wall. Their work makes you look at the world differently.
I don't like Nan Golden still, but okay.
You don't like Nan Golden still. Yeah? Who are you? What have you ever done?
I just, you know, see, but even there, I will disagree with some of the people on his list, and I will agree with some of the people on his list, right? So this right there, it's just up to whatever people think, you know? It's just silly. Yeah, I don't know. It's, he makes no distinction between types of photography, seems unaware that things have utterly changed since Cartier-Bresson.
Yeah. Why damn photography? Because of the excesses of the auction houses and mega rich collectors. Do we measure the health of contemporary art by the price paid for Hearst's vulgar diamond skull?
Right.
That's kind of my point, right? Is again, it's more money than sense. There are a lot of rich people that have really crappy taste.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think about this and I think about, let's say, I was hired to take a photograph of, I don't know, let's say somebody, Paul Krugman, right? The economist.
Okay.
New York Times writer, whatever it is. I'm a big fan of his, love to take his portrait, whatever. So let's say somebody calls me one day and says, you got to go to New Jersey, take a picture of Paul Krugman. I set up, Paul Krugman comes in, I take his picture, I leave. Now, on talking about it on this podcast, we'd be looking at it from the myopic view of, oh, let's talk about this shoot I had with Paul Krugman, how I changed the lighting, what it was like to work with him, you know, say the portrait there is, you know, is, let's say people like it or whatever, right? The rest of the world doesn't care. We, you know, I mean, we're definitely in an echo chamber.
Sure.
You know, I mean, this whole show, 138 episodes of what many people would consider an echo chamber, but these things exist for every single small, tiny slice of life nowadays, you know. There's an echo chamber for people who quilt. There's an echo chamber for people who like drinking coffee with butter in it. You know, have you tried that butter coffee stuff?
I have tried. Not a fan.
Okay. I was just wondering.
Not at all.
Seems weird to me. But you see what I'm saying is that, like, I think, yeah, it's a big stink in our world because it's something to talk about. But I don't think any of it has any influence on reality of your average Joe, you know. But I think that that's the case with a lot of stuff. Everyone thinks whatever their world is the center of the world, you know?
Yeah, but I think that I don't think the average Joe looking at this, to continue your analogy, looking at this photograph will be affected by it. But I do think that the average Joe looking at migrant mother could be affected by it, or by looking at some of, you know, Ami Vitali's recent photojournalism can be affected by it.
Yeah, but how many people? Everyone knows migrant mother, right? Everyone knows that photograph. It's a classic of photography. But how many people outside of photography think about that picture more than just, oh yeah, I've seen that picture before? You know,
point.
Like,
good
point. See what I'm saying? And it's like, I think that even there, you're putting far more attention on it than most people would. You know, I'm not saying that you're wrong for doing it. It's just it's our point of view, which is very, very small. You know, even articles like I told that story before when I was shooting the TiVo CEO guy for Business Week or something. And he didn't want to, I was supposed to have 45 minutes. He was like complaining after I shot two pictures. And I was like, look, there's going to be a full page portrait of you on one side, and there's going to be an interview of you on the other side of this page. I said, far more people are going to look at that picture of you and maybe look at the caption to see who the hell you are than are ever going to read that article on the right-hand side. So why don't you give me 20 minutes of your attention? I'll get out in half the time I was supposed to, but I'll make you look good. You know what I mean? Like there's a certain amount of thing. Now, even in my saying that to the guy, I am putting some sort of belief that my photograph of him has any importance whatsoever.
Sure. You know,
most people are going to flip through the magazine and not look at either the photograph or the thing. Or if they're going to look at the photograph, they're going to be like, hey, look, it's a guy, and keep flipping.
Right.
You know, so even within my world, I am giving attention to a small subset of reality, you know. I guess everyone has to, right? We all choose whatever battles we're going to fight in life, which is based upon whatever we're interested in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, writers will think that the written word is the most important thing and it changes the world. And it's like, yeah, it does for some people. And other people don't read a book ever after they leave high school. You know, so this is so I think that, yeah, I think it's a big deal in the sense that it makes good headlines, but I don't think it's a big deal in the larger world. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
worry that people are going to look at photography and not take it as seriously because some guy's an idiot?
No. I'm just trying to sort of reconcile value, an emotional value versus monetary value.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think that those things are in any way related.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you want them to be, and I want them to be, but as of late,
and I just like talking about it, you know.
Oh yeah, no, which is totally fine. I'm not trying to stop you from talking about it.
Yeah, I like discussing art. You know, I mean, right. In a what did Sakasagawa say in the latest email? In fact, I think he's what he said. Art is art.
Wait, was it page 15 or 16?
Yeah, right. That's right. Subset B. If we look part of it was redacted, but I still make out. Art is not a thing in itself. Art is a conversation. And like any conversation, there must be more than one person involved. It can't exist without both a speaker and a listener. And I think that's one of the things that I love about doing this show is you and I get to alternate between speaker and listener.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely.
I don't know. It's interesting to me, and I can't.
I think it's fascinating, but I also think that it's in the same way that, you know, I wish, like, I happen to be an atheist, but I wish that there was some sort of ultimate judgmental God who could say, wow, that guy was an a-hole. I hope that he lives a really sucky life.
Right.
But the world doesn't work that way, you know. I wish that things were objectively appreciated. You know, or objectively in the sense that there was some sort of scale of what people think is good and bad. What if the majority of the population who doesn't give a tear about photography thinks that lick photo is amazing? and is the best thing ever and is worth $6.5 million. Does that upset you?
It doesn't upset me because I still don't think it is.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it what it does do is, part of it is where I'm at currently in trying to value my own work.
Yeah.
And, you know, granted, it's nowhere.
Don't put it up for $6.5 million.
You know, I was thinking of 64,000.
Ah.
It's a deal.
Are you going to put a question after it?
That's right. I will. That's right. What?
All right, go ahead.
No, I just think it's in, you know, kind of where I'm at. We're seeing, I read another article where we're seeing classic photography, golden age sort of, you know, tintypes and ambrotypes and early photography fetching more and more and more money.
Yeah.
And is this another case of, well, you know, I've got all this money, I got to spend it on something. Somebody said that art was a good thing, so here's what I'll spend it on.
Yeah. Or it's some Wall Street guy who has, as you said, more money than sense. It's just like, I like old things. Here, go get me some old things.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I have a couple ambrotypes that an ex got me for Christmas a few years ago. And it's like, they're neat, but I don't think they're worth anything. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's billions of those things. Not billions.
It's just an interesting, the whole, I mean, it's, look, we've danced around it for 137 and a half episodes so far. And it's something I never get tired of. I mean, hopefully.
I mean, not just the monetary value of art, but just the value of art in society.
Yes.
The appreciation of art, and that art is more than just what some people do in their spare time because they think that they're fancy and elite. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's the way a lot of people see it. Now, those people are also watching television, which is made by a bunch of people kind of like us, you know?
Yeah.
But I've given up on trying to find a way to make the equation balance, you know?
Well, I think we're in kind of a weird spot with photography too. Was it the Taylor Wessing Award this year that was just, I kind of scratched my head.
Yeah, it was not good. And last year was really good. And
yeah.
Last year was portrait, the jockey thing.
Yeah. And it was fantastic.
Great. Yeah. And this year it was like a kid with a duck and a guy and yeah.
So I think in some ways, photography is kind of struggling to find its way again. What does it mean moving forward? What is it moving forward? I don't know. And I think this is just another sort of symptom of that.
Yeah, I think it's a symptom of the PR culture of the modern world.
Hmm.
You know, I think maybe Lick has a friend who has a lot of money. And he said, hey, man, how about you transfer $10 million into my account and I'll give you these big prints. We'll put out a press release and I'll just give it back to you next year. You know, it could be something as stupid as that. You know, I'll get lots of press. You'll get these pictures and you won't have to pay for them at all or whatever. Yeah. I mean, like you could come up with all kinds of sort of conspiracy theories.
Right.
You know, I made a joke to somebody, you know, it's like, I have friends who have millions of dollars. Hey, can you hook me up and buy my thing for $1 million so I can get on the list?
Yeah. And what was the other one that sold the piece that sold for $6.5 million and 10 cents?
Yeah. Yeah. That was the joke by some, Gary sent that over, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Very funny.
Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes as well.
So it's interesting to
me. The problem is that this gives you no more information. It was Jeff Frost.
Jeff Frost, right, right, right.
This gives you no more information when it comes to trying to value your own art, though.
Not at all.
Right. So in some ways, it's even more frustrating because it's like, wow, it's like, yeah, this is another data point, but a data point that shows absolutely no trend or curve or, you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So it's sort of, yeah, I don't know. I think that if I had that kind of money, this is not what I would be buying. You know, I don't love the Gursky photos that are at the top of the list, but I think that they're interesting, and I think that they are from a point of view, and I think that they are art in a way that this one is not.
I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, like they're neat. You know, I look at that and go, oh, that's kind of cool. Would I pay $5 million for it? Oh, no.
Right.
But
right.
If I was at a gallery and they had big giant 20-foot prints on the wall, I'd stare at them for 5 minutes.
You know? I would still look, it's still at the top of my list for big kind of things like that is still Gregory Crudson.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because then you can see people in them and stuff. Hey, let me ask you a question, a slightly unrelated question. Do you rewatch movies all the time?
Yes.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Seriously, oh, like yeah. You own movies and you watch them over and
oh,
over
yeah.
again?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What do you get out of that? I mean, there's movies that I watch a lot. Like, I've watched Hunt for Red October a ton of times. I've watched, you know what I mean? I've seen a lot of things a number of times.
Depends on the movie.
Okay.
You know, for something like Fight Club,
yeah.
which I've seen probably 50 times.
Really? Okay.
The first dozen or so times you pick up little things, or you know, you catch little camera angle things that you didn't notice before, or scenes in the, you know, little items in the background, or yeah. set dressing, or same with Blade Runner. Some I don't.
Okay.
You know, like when Star Wars came out,
we've all seen Star Wars 50
but
times.
But like in that summer, I saw Star Wars 26 times that summer.
You kidding me? In the theater.
In the theater.
Okay, so you're a little obsessive that way anyway then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. It was just like a weekend because it, you know, back then it was, you know, movies were in the theater all summer long. Like summer blockbusters, they were there all summer.
Right. If so it was the summer blockbuster, it was the summer blockbuster.
Yeah. It's like, well, what do you want to do? I want to go to the movies.
Right.
Okay. Well, yeah. You know, so for, you know, and sometimes you'd stay and watch it twice.
Yeah. Right. Sure. No, you're one of those. The original.
Yeah.
The OG you know? Slime ball.
That's right. Well, they didn't care. Come on. They didn't care. But yeah, some movies I do. Some movies I don't. Or, you know, TV series. I mean, I've watched Arrested Development a bunch of times. 30 okay. Rock, I never get tired
yeah,
of.
I've watched West Wing a number of times.
Yeah. Seinfeld. Yeah.
I just, I know, I've met people who... you know, have libraries of, say, movies on Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll watch the movies over and over and over again. And I certainly do that with music.
Yeah.
But I've never thought to do that with, I've never done that really with movies. I mean, there's a handful of movies I've seen a bunch of times, but I've never.
And then, you know, sometimes they're just sort of, you know, they're perennials or right. you know, every Christmas I watch, you know, Love Actually or, right, you know, right, every right, Thanksgiving right. you watch. Right.
Every birthday, Conrad's birthday, we watch Jaws.
Yeah. Yep. So, you know, there are those
like
things.
A doll's
you watch.
Eyes.
Yeah. you know, it just kind of. It kind of depends on the flick, but yeah, I sometimes read books over and over again, you know, yeah. Sometimes you just want to go back to that world.
Yeah. I guess my thing is that yes, there are images that I've looked at over and over again, but if you combined all the time I've stared at, you know, every photograph in history, including my own, excluding my own stuff that I've worked on for hours. Have I looked at anybody else's photograph for more than half an hour?
Probably not.
Cumulative. Right. It's an interesting thing. You know, it's just, I wonder if that's different because, I mean, same thing with paintings too, you know, as much as I love, I mean, I spent 20, 25 minutes staring at the Calling of St. Matthew when I was in Rome last year.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of staring at the real thing. And I've stared at prints of it or whatever it is, but that may be the longest I've ever stared at anything, you know?
I love revisiting things, you know, seeing the Rauschenberg in the Hirschhorn and being, you know, I asked the girl that was kind of guarding the room. I said, you know, how close can I get? And she said, just don't touch it. You know, so
did you pull down those like weird little jeweler's glasses? Yes. You know, just yeah. get like a
yeah. So, you know, I'm a couple inches away and I'm looking at you know, tears and brush strokes and drips and
yeah.
And I like looking at things that way. I like looking at how things were assembled.
Do you ever think though that, like, if you're looking at, say, a drip of paint or something, right?
Uh-huh.
Do you imbue that drip with meaning, or was it like a, oh, he happened to drip while he was going over to paint this other thing?
It depends, because I've done them both ways. I've had accidental drips, and then on some pieces I've gone, you know what would look really cool? It would look cool if I looked, if it looked like I dripped some paint right there, and I'll paint in drips.
Right. So how do you know?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not that, you know, I'm not that adept at, yeah.
Whenever I go to MoMA, there's always, there's a bunch of people around Starry Night, but if you get there when it's not busy, you notice that he didn't paint to the edge of the canvas, and there's actually like bare canvas around the edge, which isn't the kind of thing you notice, and definitely not the kind of thing you'd see on a print of it, because they'll always crop that out.
Right.
But it's sort of like a the dirty edges, you know.
I like technique.
Yeah.
And I just got this book on Degas at the recommendation of Michelle at the National Gallery, as a matter of fact, National Portrait Gallery. National Gallery, on his technique and how he went from paint to pastel to sculpture and some of the techniques that he used in there. And it's fascinating to unpack that and to see or to read rather what led to it or what inspired these changes. I mean, Degas was going blind. So if you look at some of his work, you see in his later work that figures will have darker outlines around them so he could see them in part, you know. And I'm still learning. I knew virtually nothing about him before talking to Michelle and starting to read some books and some online things about him. And I'm just fascinated by why he did what he did, why he chose to use the type of medium that he did, or, you know, I got impatient with waiting for oils to dry. So I'm going to move to pastels because I can get my ideas and concepts and thoughts and art down quicker and move on to the next thing. And there's this sort of frenetic kind of creation that I imagine anyway, that's going on.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, just going back for half a second, there's an example of how photography is part of art, in the sense that even if you don't like photography, how photography has changed painting and sculpture and everything else, you know.
Sure.
The fact that Degas paintings have people coming in halfway off the side of the side of the canvas.
The side of his 4K monitor.
Right. In a way that they would have in a photograph that people wouldn't have thought to do before photography, or, you know what I mean? Any kinds of stuff like that. Or the people who are trying to do really realistic stuff got overtaken by photography. So that allowed, freed up painters to do more abstract work, or, you know.
Yeah, we were talking about
Then you get to Richard Estes, who goes back and now takes photographs and repaints them as realist sort of perfect paintings, versions of his photographs. So it's like all of this stuff intersects in ways that you can't just write in a 200 word article, you know.
I completely agree. And I think part of what I get a lot of joy out of, I don't think I know, part of what I get a lot of joy out of is seeking out those connections.
Yeah.
You suggested a book about color.
Oh yeah. Did you get that one?
I've got it on order. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was talking to,
I'll find it.
It's on the bookshelf. It is called Bright Earth by Philip Ball.
Yeah. Which was, recommended to me by a friend of mine who's a painting teacher who, also does a lot of stuff with Golden. So she's really into that.
So I've got that on order. I was talking to Christopher Matheson yesterday, and he suggested this other one called Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay, that is very – it seems to be very similar in scope, how color came to be and what you know, spices and materials were ground down to make pigment, and how these pigments, you know, have come to mean and what they mean. And so I'm fascinated by this, and I'm finding that – that's part of what.
Are you going to start grinding and mining your own pigments?
You know, I wouldn't mind trying it. You mean, like, who is it that's on the list that roasts his own coffee? Yeah, see, if you'd go to the group once in a while, you'd see these things.
Actually, whenever anybody mentions coffee, I just zone out.
Yeah, Jeff Preston uses an air popper and was, and you know, I guess Matheson asked him about it and he posted some photos of it. Anyway.
Wait, he roasts coffee inside of a popcorn popper?
Oh yeah. It's a very popular way to do it.
I had no idea. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to do a little tweaking to the heating
element.
Wait, people
grind these beans and then put hot water over them?
Yes. And then they drink it.
They drink that stuff? That sludge? That wastewater?
Ugh. Careful, mister. You're treading on some thin ice.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, you know, this is kind of fuel, right? In seeing how these things are done and, you know, it's, I've got a list of processes that I want to explore in 2015.
Sure.
And caustic is one, wet plate's another. And so
I've gotten a lot of emails from people wondering how I did the little corner stuff and the fat paint stuff that I used and
yeah.
asking me questions.
And it's,
so yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting. And it's fun. So there's that.
It's exciting.
It is exciting.
You know, Jeffrey, if you want to learn how to do new things, there's one easy way to do it.
All right, you ready?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Did you work on it again?
I did.
Okay, go ahead.
Little Copacabana inspired thing.
Oh, God.
Right? I don't know if I'm going to be able to. Her name is Linda. She teaches software from Photoshop to InDesign. You can learn it all online for just 1 monthly fee. It's there for you and me.
Wow, that was really good. I think that may have been your best yet.
Yeah?
Yeah. How much time did you spend on that?
Linda.com. You know, they kind of pop into my head every once in a while. It's really kind of
freaky.
You know, concerning. Yeah. I don't know what's more worrisome, the fact that I was sitting here listening to Copacabana or the fact that – I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, tell me about
– We're talking about Linda.com.
Tell me about Linda.com.
You guys know this stuff. This is an easy way, an affordable way to help individuals learn online. Instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on business, software, web development, graphic design, and more. Linda.com works with industry experts, you know, people much smarter than Jeffrey or I.
Hey, now.
Okay, people much smarter than Jeffrey. And Linda works directly with industry experts and software companies to provide timely training, often the same day that new versions or releases hit the market, so you're always up to speed. So new Photoshop CC 2014 Beta 2 Plus 1 comes out. Linda's going to tell you all about the new stuff that's on there. All courses are produced at the highest quality, not like the homemade videos you see on YouTube. Insert us making fun of those people here. Go ahead.
All right. So today we're going to look at the levels, which are
the best is when it's like some little tiny kid working on some 1024 by 768 Windows box. He's like, yeah. So, you know, we're here, we're in Photoshop, and you're like, you're 12. What the hell is going on? These kids nowadays.
Yeah.
The courses are broken up into bite-sized pieces so you can learn at your own pace and learn from start to finish, or just find a quick answer. So you want to go in and learn about how to, I don't know, give me something to learn.
Well, let's say you want to learn layout foundations. You know,
oh, there you go.
Composition and layout.
Yeah,
you can learn it. You want to learn about the golden mean? You want to learn about
or designing, you know, on a grid?
Designing on a grid, sure. Yep. Rule of thirds, rule of odds.
Yeah. Tools include searchable transcripts, playlists, and certificate of course completion. So you could go right in there and look for golden ratio and find all the different things that discuss golden ratio. You can also publish to your LinkedIn profile, which is great if you're a professional in the field and you want to show that you actually know how to use these things. So whether you're a beginner or advanced, Lynda.com has courses for all experience levels. And you can learn while you're on the go with Lynda.com apps for the iPhone, iPad, and Android. One low monthly price of $25 gives you unlimited access to over 100,000 video tutorials. So what are you doing this Christmas season? I'm going to go on Lynda.com and learn right. everything from 100,000 different video tutorials.
You can even give a gift.
That is such a good idea.
Yeah. Gift somebody, like, you know somebody, gift them a year, gift them 3 months, gift them
really
a month.
Is that really possible?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm looking right now. Gifting 25 a month. They're running a special right now. 3 month is 59.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, it
60
is.
60 bucks for 3 months.
Or the premium is $299, and that's the one that comes with all the project files that you can follow along.
So the premium is an annual thing.
Yep.
Okay. Premium members with the annual plan can download courses to their iPhone, iPads, or Android devices, which is great. So you can watch them while you're on the subway or traveling or on an airplane. Premium plan members can also download project files and practice along with their instructor, as Jeffrey just mentioned. And, you know, so if you're the kind of person who wants to go exactly along with what the guy's doing on the screen, you can do that.
I find a lot of value in that personally.
Yeah. Some people do and some people don't. So yeah, totally.
There's a benchmark. You can go, okay, I'm
doing the same exact thing as them and mine doesn't look exactly the same. So what am I doing differently?
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, totally. And, for software you can rely on, lynda.com can help you stay current with all software updates, learn the ins and outs of your software tools to be more efficient and productive. So, look, we've worked out a deal with lynda.com. It's Christmas, after all, to provide you with a special offer to access all the courses free for 10 days. So just visit lynda.com/OTP. That's lynda.com/OnTakingPictures as an OTP. And and try lynda.com for free for 10 days. So thank you very much for Lynda for supporting 5x5 and On Taking Pictures. Good stuff. Very, very cool stuff. People should give gifts. That's a good gift. What? Why are you laughing?
I don't know.
Did I make a joke?
I'm just a dork. Yeah, gifts are good.
You know
what are good gifts? Books are good gifts.
Yeah, you know what this is? But it's like you're gifting experience in some way. You know what I mean? Not just a piece of gear necessarily, but like to somebody who... That's pretty great. So yeah, check that out. Lynda.com. All right, I didn't see these videos. You put them in late. So what are these Eastman House videos?
They are terrific. They're a series of 12 videos. They originally had, I think they originally had six up, and they've gone back and added six more. And it's kind of like Eastman House's version of The Genius of Photography, the BBC show.
Okay, sure. In fact, they actually use some of what's his name's. Who's the guy who did the really cool camera obscura in the rooms?
Oh,
Abe.
Yeah.
Morello.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I will check these out.
Yeah,
where the heck is the Eastman Museum getting the money to do these things?
I don't know. Maybe private funding?
Yeah.
I don't know. But it's really cool.
Just to show you how hard it was back in the day.
Yeah, it's called Before Photography, the Photographic Processes Series, and there are 12.
I will put a link in the show notes.
Platinum prints, daguerreotypes, albumen prints, Talbot's process, color photography, pigment process.
Yeah, you know, I'll give a shout out to the Capturing the Light book as well, which is still a great book.
Okay, yeah, you've liked that.
Yeah, still a great book.
I'm excited about these. I haven't watched these. Patrick sent this to me last night.
So Patrick's been watching them for the last week and a half.
Probably not. I think he's out using his new camera.
What did he end up buying?
Well, he bought the A6000, sent that back,
right,
and then
exactly.
Rebought it because he missed it, and bought the A7 II. So I'm anxious
so wait,
to
he has
hear
both
how
of
he
them?
Likes. Yeah, yeah.
Because he's going to keep both of them, or he's trying both of them out?
No, he'll keep both of them.
Must be nice, huh?
I just hope he decides where he wants to hang his Peter Lick print.
it's got to be something like that.
He's
right?
The one who bought the yeah. I'm curious to see what he thinks about it because this thing five axis stabilization built into
it's that Mad Murphy Brown money. Must have been good times.
Good time.
All right, we will put those in the show notes. You know, I was up at Mass MoCA last week.
Yeah.
And saw a documentary. Well, here's the thing. Okay, saw a movie, a 27-minute movie called Black Drop by an artist named Simon Starling. Now, I think I mentioned this last week because he did. If you might recall me mentioning Shed Boat Shed.
Right.
His piece of work where he took a shed, turned it into a boat, rode it down the river, and then pulled it out and turned it back into a shed.
What did he put in the shed?
I don't know. All the money he made from doing Shed Boat Shed. His Turner Prize he won by doing Shed Boat Shed.
Right.
But this, the piece that I saw of his was this movie talking about photographing the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Black Drop. and it talks about, you know, photographing the moon, different celestial things transiting the sun, or taking pictures of the moon using telescopes, or the big giant telescope arrays we have now, and how much better all this stuff is, and sort of interdispersed with this somewhat monotonous, very sort of PBS-y voiceover, is our intersections of it's intercut with a guy sitting at a Seamback, which is a machine for editing film, actually editing the movie that you're watching, is sort of the idea that comes across to me.
Okay.
And the thing is that this is a very, very interesting, the stuff that he's talking about as far as photographing the moon and stuff, or the transit of Venus across the sun and photographing the moon and all these things, are fascinating unto themselves. And this movie is in my mind a documentary. However, it's sitting in a contemporary art museum as an art piece.
Mm-hmm.
So when does documentary?
So what's the line?
Yeah, when does documentary become art?
Why is this documentary, or why is this art, but Ken Burns is documentary?
Exactly. Right.
Hmm.
What do you think?
I don't understand. I don't claim to understand a lot of.
By the way, I'll put a link to the show notes of like a 2-minute 33-second excerpt that's up on Vimeo called "Excerpt of Black Drop Silent Starling." So some of you want to get a taste of what it was like. This is pretty cool. I think you even watched it and liked it, right? You thought it was cool.
I did.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Now I lost my train of thought.
The line Dick. Between documentary and
yeah,
Ken Burns.
I mean, I don't claim to have any sort of insider knowledge of what constitutes what.
Wait, you're not the arbiter of good taste?
Well, I am.
I'm one of them.
I don't. Are we too caught up with labels in the first place? I mean, does there have to be a separation?
No, but I guess what I'm saying is that somebody decided this should be in a very sort of artsy contemporary art museum.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, if this was on PBS, it would not be out of place.
So what makes this, in your mind, what is it? Is it the subject matter that makes it art, or is it the way it's assembled?
Or that it was made by somebody who's a conceptual artist.
So because it's like you can't go back to not being an Academy Award right. winner. You're always from
yeah.
henceforth going to be an Academy Award
yeah.
winner.
Yeah. Well, okay. Look at take Shepard Fairey, right? The Hope poster.
Right.
That you could, if he wasn't Shepard Fairey and some graphic designer just did that by doing posterize inside of Photoshop and stuck Hope down the bottom.
Hey, that's not what he does. Man.
I know that's not what he does, but I'm saying you could get a similar effect by doing that.
On the surface, maybe, but right. if you look at the subtleties, it's really night and day.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that it's not. I actually like that piece, and I like a lot of his work. But what I'm saying is there are graphic designers who do equal amounts of manipulation to just create a poster for some graphic, for some, you know, concert that's going
right.
on.
Right.
So why is it that because he made it, it's art that's on people's walls versus just something that, you know, is a paste-up that gets pulled down because the show's over next week, you know?
That is a good question. And I don't have an answer for you.
You know, cause you watch this thing and yes, there's a lot of things that this Simon Starling guy has done, which are kind of out there artistic, sort of the kind of stuff that your average person would say that's art. You know, mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. some of the funky stuff, but this is very run of the mill. In fact, in some ways you almost wonder if there's an artistic undercurrent to the whole thing that he's trying to imbue it with. Like what I saw as just this documentary film was a superficial interpretation of whatever it is that he was trying to say.
Okay.
And that if anything, it's at fault for me for not seeing the subtext.
But is this more art than say the Paul Strand film that we saw in Philly? Does this more deserving of a spot in a museum or a gallery than that was? And if so, why?
Well, the Paul Strand film was in many ways just clumps of street scenes that he shot with a movie camera, right?
but it's in one of the most respected museums in the country.
Would it have been there if Paul Strand wasn't this photographer and they were showing a bunch of his photography and, oh yeah, we have this film, so we'll show the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I doubt that film alone would have been enough to warrant a space, you know? I find it fascinating. I still want to find a somewhere online where you could watch this whole thing, but I don't think you can, which really stinks because it's very cool. You know, we're getting to the point where that should be an option, you know? Like, I would pay $2.99 to watch this thing again.
Where everything is just simultaneously released online.
Yeah. Like, aren't we?
Yeah,
to
I don't
the
understand
where,
the licensing.
Because you know what? Mass MoCA is not. This is. I mean, I happen to be going to Vermont to visit family. But. And so we kind of went near it. And I said, well, you know, why don't we take the afternoon and go over and see this thing? But I wouldn't otherwise.
Hey, I've been to a museum with you. I'm surprised you could sit still for 20 minutes.
Hey, you wanted to see two things. I had to. You came all the way to Philly. I got to show you a couple things. Anyway.
Yeah, if you ever go to a museum with Bill. Wear good shoes.
It's true. Although I don't usually go that fast. However, I would do that museum in 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I don't take as much time as you do. I don't know. Maybe that's why I don't watch things over and over and over again.
Maybe. Yeah. I like to absorb things. I like to just sit and study nuance.
Yeah.
And
where for me, if something doesn't hit me within 10 seconds, I feel like it's not going to hit me.
ADD.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Hey, for that.
What does it matter what poets think of photography?
I found this fascinating. Okay, this is an article from the Paris Review, which I love.
Yeah.
And
hoity-toity. Yeah. No. Jeffrey, seriously, tell us all about the Paris Review.
Well.
And your love of it.
Shut up.
Wait, you're not wearing your beret. Put the beret on.
Let me get my croissant. So the latest issue of Aperture, actually what they're talking about, the latest issue of Aperture magazine focuses on the relationship between literature and photography.
Okay.
And this article on Paris Review reads that the editors were kind enough to share the feature below in which four poets discuss some of their favorite photographs. It appears in Aperture magazine number 217 for those of you who are interested. Winter 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's interesting how we have our favorite, in quotes, photographs that probably change. And to see the perspective of what is a favorite for other people, I just find it fascinating.
Their choices were odd to me.
Yeah. I was not familiar with any of them.
Right.
And,
neither was I. Somewhat arbitrary, no?
I don't know that I would say they're arbitrary. This first one, though, John Ashbery, Sergio Lorraine, Boulevard Saint-Germain before the, what would you say, Du Mago Café?
You're asking the wrong guy. I'm terrible at that.
Okay. So the caption reads, and I love this, the caption reads, I lived in Paris mostly from 1955 to 1965. This photograph called Boulevard Saint-Germain before the Du Mago Café, I believe that's right, I don't know, Paris 1959 by Sergio Lorraine. The café was a favorite hangout of mine, at least when I was flush enough to afford it. It could conceivably have been there when the picture, I could conceivably have been there when the picture was taken. The photograph sums up beautifully the atmosphere of Paris on a rather chilly autumn afternoon with well-dressed and well-behaved tourists sipping their cafe. The mood that this photograph sort of captures and the time, maybe it's the time, maybe it's I'm romanticizing the
50s in
the late 50s in Paris. You know, maybe Avedon was somewhere around here taking photographs, and I like to think about that.
Sure.
But a lovely photograph. And it just, I don't know, I thought it was really fascinating how the photographs in each case were kind of tied to different events for this first fellow.
Certainly events in those people's lives, right?
Yeah. For this first fellow, the photograph recalled a happy time in his life.
Right.
And it's I would look at my own sort of family photographs in that way, but I wouldn't choose any of my favorite photographs based on how they relate to my life.
Yeah, but you may have unconsciously chosen them based upon what was going on in your life, no?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the stuff that I would gravitate towards, the early Avedon work. I mean, obviously I wasn't even alive then. So, you know, it's a time and place that I maybe wish I could have experienced.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah.
More so than the technical nature of the photograph.
Right. But you and I also have, I think everyone does. I like a certain kind of photography for because it speaks to me because of my experiences and my upbringing and my education and my interests, you know?
See, if that were the case, then Eggleston would probably be at the top of my list because it's very sort of banal and it's, you know, subdivisions and strip malls and, you know, that kind of thing.
I have learned to like, say, Dwayne Michaels photography, but I am not naturally precluded to, you know, I don't naturally like stuff like Dwayne Michaels creates.
Right.
But I appreciate it because I've met the guy and I've looked at it a lot and I've heard him speak and whatnot. But that's not naturally what I would go for. You're saying that because you grew up where you grew up in a certain time, you should like Eggleston because he was shooting in the 70s and places
If you're saying that I would choose something based on my own life experience.
Yeah.
Now for just purely,
I don't mean a direct equivalence, but I do mean that, you know, you may not like, you know, incredibly romantic stuff about babies, like the Geddes stuff we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Because you don't have kids and you know
right,
what I mean? Like,
right.
But for some people, they've always loved children. And so those pictures mean something more to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
no, I got you. I mean, I flocked to, like I said, the early Avedon stuff, Gregory Crudson, of course.
Sure.
Because that world, I want to step into that world. And it's, I don't know what that says, because often they're worlds of isolation and disconnection and that kind of thing. But maybe because that's the way I feel most of the time anyway.
Of you inside of Jeffrey's mind.
Yeah. You know, I don't feel connected to my environment. I don't feel connected to the world around me. I feel like I'm on the world, not in the world. And so maybe that's why those particular photographs have such a draw for me.
Yeah. Yeah. You might be right. It's interesting.
Yeah.
There's always a certain question that I have about the argument that it's somehow photographs are more meaningful. Sometimes I feel like this is trying to attach meaning to photography because people think that poetry is important. So if we have poets talk about their favorite photographs, that will imbue the photographs with importance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean,
but at
yeah,
the same time, if anything, the influence of poetry is probably as low as it's ever been, you know, in the general public. You know, how many people read poetry? Percentage has to be tiny, you know.
Probably, yeah.
So it's sort of like, okay, well, you have this very highly respected, super super small niche trying to give some sort of lay some claim to, you know. It's like if you had brought in, would this have the same emphasis had you brought in J.J. Abrams and Cameron and who's the woman who did Hurt Locker, Bigelow, and
Catherine
whatever
Bigelow.
It is, to choose their favorite photographs, would it have the same gravitas?
No, wait, did Catherine Bigelow do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I think it was. That and Point Break. What?
Yes, that's right. Which thankfully the remake has been halted.
Thank God.
I know. Yeah. It was
How
Gerard
could you remake
Butler.
What is so
Gerard
perfect?
Gerard Butler.
It's perfect as it is.
Yeah.
It's like when they remade, what's the one on Mars with Schwarzenegger? Total Recall. Don't need to do it. Total Recall's yeah. fine film as it is.
Yeah.
It's perfection.
I'll respectfully disagree.
Anyway, we'll put the link in the show notes. Jeffrey, maybe what you need to do is get out into the world and just travel the entire world by foot for 2 years.
This was
actually
another
not
one.
2 years, 5 years.
5 years. This guy went all around the world, 201 countries, Graham Hughes, 33, without ever getting on an airplane.
Must be nice.
And only spent $100 a week to do it.
Which is kind of unbelievable, but impressive.
Yeah. 160,000 miles, 1,426 days, according to the article on the Daily Mail, used buses, taxis, trains, and his own 2 feet.
That part's fascinating. The parts that scare the crap out of me is being jailed in the Congo for a week for being a spy, arrested trying to sneak into Russia, and had to be rescued from Muslim fundamentalists by a Filipino ladyboy named Jen.
Right.
Like, I'm sure that those are all great experiences in hindsight, but the point at which, you know, Muslim fundamentalists and, you know, some crazy guys in the Congo with AK-47s are trying to put you in a jail that you don't know that you're ever going to get out of.
There is something...
You love the romance of it.
I do. I do. Because it's something I could never do.
Yeah.
Right? It's something I could never do. He tells the Christian Science Monitor, I love travel. And I guess my reason for doing it was I wanted to see if it could be done by one person traveling on a shoestring. I think I also wanted to show that the world is not some big scary place, but is in fact full of people who want to help you, even if you're a stranger, except maybe in the Congo when you're jailed for being a spy.
Yeah. Right.
But it is absolutely fascinating. He has traversed the borders of all 193 members of the United Nations, plus Taiwan, Vatican City, Palestine, Kosovo, Western Sahara, and the four home nations of the United Kingdom, all without flying. Guinness is now confirmed, et cetera, et cetera.
How did he start? He just liked traveling, and so he decided to start going around the world?
Apparently.
What did he do before that?
It doesn't
say. And $100 a week, so that's $5,200 a year. He's out for 5 years. Where'd he get the $30,000?
I don't know. Does that matter?
No, I was just wondering.
That's secondary.
Well, I was just wondering about the logistics.
Yeah,
It also seems like he talked his way into a lot of free rides and stuff, right?
It sounds like it.
It's totally cool.
Yeah, this is kind of the Corey Neistat taken to the nth degree.
Yes.
You know? Yep. Who, another Corey Neistat. If you don't know Corey, Casey Neistat. Go check out his stuff. He's another guy who just his life is so beyond my comfort zone that I love reading about what he does. I'm sorry.
Well, my friend who traded a paperclip up to a house.
Right.
It's like
that's a certain
kind of balls you got there. You know?
Yeah. Interesting. Totally. Anyway.
I think you should leave tomorrow.
I'm not going anywhere, mister.
Okay.
Not like that.
I'm just saying.
So,
yes. How do people do?
How do we? Would you just show up every once in a while?
I want to know your opinion.
To post your own stuff. Just
I was
quit
there,
looking for a hug.
Robin. I was there during the making of one of those.
Ugh. Okay. So some great stuff for Joy. Nobody jumping for Joy, sadly.
Jumping for Joy, huh? That would have been a good one.
Yeah. Well, you all fail. So I hope you're happy.
This is why I don't chime in, because you've got your own opinions.
Because you all, yeah. Great stuff. Really great stuff from Gary. Bobby Tingle, good stuff. Jerome, shot of a newborn, his newborn. Newborn daughter. What do we get a name? I don't think we have a name. Chime in, Jerome. I'd love to find out your name.
Wait, can we comment also that Gavin Wu's collage that came last week of the dog? Have you seen this one? Where he's holding up a picture of the dog next to the dog.
Yeah,
over the dog. That's pretty good.
Pretty genius. Yeah, that was really good. There was one of my favorites. Mark Link. Did you see this picture that he took in Morocco of the woman kind of opening the door? It was like the carved wooden door. It's all sort of oranges and browns,
and
then
beautiful.
She's wearing the blue. Ugh, I love that shot. A lot of good stuff. Millie, Jason, you guys are having a good time. So this time, Preston, love that shot of the down tube. This time, broken.
Ooh.
Broken.
Okay.
So is this metaphorically broken? Is it actually physically broken? Is it emotionally broken? How broken are you? I don't know.
Very.
Very. Yeah.
Wait, we're talking about you? Oh,
yeah. Oh, wait. Look, I could use one for selfie and broken. So, yeah. Okay, Gavin, I also want to know, who drew, did you draw that? Is it a print? I want to know.
Oh, of the dog.
Of the dog.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out.
Oh, okay. Then turned. Okay. Turned to black. Okay. Okay. So it is, it's a photograph. I was going to say, that's pretty amazing. It's still
really cool.
Did you
really want him
cool
to draw
shot.
It?
I did.
Well, you know.
C for effort, Gavin.
Life's full of all kinds of small disappointments, I guess.
That's right.
That's good stuff.
Okay.
So who's our photographer?
Jim Azevedo. That's a cool, the J and the Y in the yard. I don't know where the
Yeah, o I saw that one. To.
You've lost your O, Jim.
It was stolen.
Somebody stole the O. Yeah. So broken is the next one.
Yep.
So have fun with that. What do you think of this photographer of the week? This was Carl sent this in.
Yes, he did. I think that she is great.
We're talking about Jane Bone. Bone?
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 I would say Bone.
Bone? Jane Bone.
Yeah.
I think so, too.
So we're talking about Jane Bone. She's been around since the 50s. Been around forever. Has shot pretty much everybody you could ever imagine somebody shooting like that.
Yeah. The first photo that I ever saw is probably maybe one of the ones. It was the Beckett one, the Samuel Beckett shot.
I wish I was there to take a picture of Samuel Beckett.
Yeah. And I saw the Mick Jagger shot. Those were the first two that I had seen by her. And I just didn't go beyond that and look her up. But yeah. Thank you, Carl, for sending this in because her stuff is absolutely terrific.
The Marty Feldman picture, you know that one? The guy with the crazy spooky eyes who was
I know Marty Feldman. I haven't seen the photo.
Yeah, if you just search for her on Google image search, it comes up. It's a pretty good one where he's like smoking a cigarette and his head is in his hands. Available light. So super minimal setup kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, that's a great shot.
Isn't that funny?
Yep, it's a great shot.
It's pretty cool. Super minimal, available light, black and white, working since 1949, started at the Observer over in the UK. Yeah. Hey, what do you think about the fact that, okay, how many photographers have we talked about from the 60s or whatever who shot Beckett, who shot Mick Jagger, who shot, you know, Lennon or, you know what I mean? All these people, right?
Okay.
Is there a certain equivalence to them because they had a similar set of subjects? You know,
in terms of what, like comparing like Seliger to Miller Mobley or something?
Yeah, because something they've like got that. Kind of access. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a familiarity in seeing not only these same subjects, but seeing them represented in similar ways, and then the standouts where they're represented differently.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, like, look how many people we've talked about who have taken pictures of Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Yeah. And how many of them are about the photographer, and how many of them are about the fact that Marilyn Monroe was just easy to take pictures of and would play to the camera a lot?
Well,
as we said, that Beckett picture that you like, there's a Cartier-Bresson picture of Beckett that's very of a similar ilk because Beckett just looked cool, you know?
Yes.
I'm not taking anything away from Jane Bone. I'm just a discussion.
Right. There are going to be some similarities, certainly.
Yeah.
I wonder if the changes were, or the inconsistencies were more or less then or now.
Wait, say that sentence again. I missed it.
Well, were they different, or were they recognizable because of subject matter?
Right.
Were they recognizable because of process?
So you're saying 30 years from now, will every picture of Steven Spielberg look similar that was taken around this time?
Right.
Yeah, right. Probably.
Do all of the photos of Beckett taken around then look the same because they were all basically natural light, black and white at that time?
Yeah, yeah. And now it's all overlit soft lights, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Could be. Not certain. I mean, and imagine being a newspaper portrait photographer in the 1950s in London as a woman, you know,
probably not very easy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were certain advantages of it because I'm sure a lot of the men would rather have a woman around than a man. You know what I mean? There's an argument there.
Maybe. Yeah.
You know, you get a certain angle because
I wonder just gender notwithstanding, what was access like then versus now?
It was very different.
Were there as many layers and levels you needed to go through?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I mean, would you call up maybe a publicist or an agent and that was it?
Would you call
the person directly?
I think she shot most of these things as for assignments, right? You know? It was, you know, Beckett has a new book out. We need a picture of Beckett for the newspaper. Go take a picture of Beckett. You know, here's his contact info. I mean, the same thing that happens to me or anybody else like me, you know. But I certainly don't think that it's nowadays. The problem is you go take pictures of somebody who has their picture taken a lot and they have their picture taken so often, each trying to make your experience with those people in the camera different than any one of the other 500 they've done this year is difficult, right? I have 10 minutes with this person. How do I do something that is both end product different and is also experientially different so that maybe they lose themselves and they give me 15 or 20 minutes instead of just the 10 instead of looking at their watch the whole time.
You've got 10 minutes with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
Go make it unique.
Right. Where I think that, let's say it was Michael Caine in the 1950s, I doubt that he had his portrait taken as much as Benedict Cumberbatch is now.
Right.
You know, see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was a little bit more special of an experience and therefore a little less annoying to the people.
Right.
Maybe.
Speaking of Benedict Cumberbatch, The Hollywood Reporter has a terrific set by Miller Mobley, and Benedict is one of them. Also, Michael Keaton is another one. Really, really, really nice set of photographs.
Ah, Hollywood. What's it like living out there in Hollywood?
I don't live in Hollywood. I don't even go to Hollywood.
You love Hollywood. You don't love Hollywood?
No.
Really?
No.
Some people.
I go to LA to shoot, like downtown or to Little Tokyo or, but like Hollywood, no real interest.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to Miss
Jane Bowne.
There's a terrific, little, not really documentary, but video clip on The Guardian. It kind of gives like a nice overview of her work. And boy, there's something about the simplicity of the work pre-color. And I know I'm going to probably piss off a lot of people, but there is just something almost more holistic about.
What do you mean black by holistic?
There's something about it that for me gets closer to the core of
because it's in black and white or because they feel less posed.
I can't put my finger on it,
but at the same time, people, if you took a similar picture today of, you know, any one of the billions of people who get their picture taken, it wouldn't stand out today. If it was just a window-led portrait of so-and-so.
Even somebody contemporary. I saw there's a terrific portrait of Jeff Bridges.
Sure.
And, you know, you've seen Jeff Bridges in any number of photographs, many color, many black and white. But it's the black and white ones that I feel like I'm looking at him.
Hmm.
And I don't know quite how to explain it.
That's probably because there's only black and white in your childhood and you got used to it. I mean, do you really think that that's true? Or do you think that the, see, you know, it's like, I look at the pictures and I look at, say, who took this picture? Let me visit this page.
I mean, I can point you to any number of black and white. There's one, Michael Mueller. There's, Marco Storch. I don't know. I feel like I'm looking more at the heart of someone in black and white, by and large.
Yeah, maybe you are. I don't know. It's funny. I oftentimes will switch my stuff to black and white, and then I will end up coming back to color. You know. Maybe if you shot it in black and white, it would be different.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Where you didn't have an option, you know.
I don't know. But this type of work by Ms. Bound really speaks to me.
She's still around. Let's find her.
Yeah. And do what?
I don't know. Hang out with her. She's in London. I'll give her a call.
Okay. You do that. Where are we at? Podcast.
Yep.
At ontakingpictures.com. What are we doing on time? Are we okay? How are you feeling? You feeling okay?
I'm okay.
You're probably going to go lay down, aren't you?
Yeah, I will after this. Sorry for being a little down today.
That's all right.
But yeah, we will talk to you next week. Let's see. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com, at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris. Our phone number, if you want to leave us a voicemail, we like the voicemails.
Yeah, go ahead.
347-687-9411. And we got a few this week and I like them. They're fun hearing people's voices.
It is.
Especially when people yell at us.
What was I going to say? Huh? What? I don't remember. That's what happens. I don't remember. I'll come back next week.
Apparently Bound had a very troubled childhood. So we should, there's a documentary apparently, Looking for Light, which, IMDb from what year was this? This was this year.
She was, to mark her 80th birthday, this was an article in 2006. So she's 88? Is that right?
She was, 1925. So she is, she would be 88. Yeah. That adds up.
Huh.
Weird, right?
A career that spans more than 50 years.
Imagine having a career that spans 50 years.
Claims she became a photographer almost by accident. She took it up at the end of the Second World War after leaving the Wrens. Over the years, the revealing portraits she's taken for The Observer have become legendary. She works in black and white, avoids artificial lighting, and has a tremendous knack for capturing the personality of her sitter.
Do you think that's true?
That she has a tremendous knack for capturing the personality of her sitter?
Yeah, do you think that that's true of I mean, any one of these people that we like portrait things, is that a truism or is that a something we like to add as like a glossy thing of trying to add meaning to something?
They're all capturing game face?
No, I think that we see what we want to see, you know?
Hmm.
You know, people say that about my pictures and I go, I don't know. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe that's all just in my own mind.
So do you capture the person or do you capture the person they want you to see?
Yeah. Or
is that the mark of a really excellent photographer creating a relationship or a connection with a subject where those facades are stripped away?
Or that's all just one big... not lie, but just sort of like, no, that's not really how it is. Like we like to add that level of romance to the whole thing, but really it's just a picture of the dude, you know?
Are we talking about the dude, Jeff Bridges?
I was going to wait for you to make that joke.
Yeah.
I don't know. I go back and forth on that sometimes. Like, or do we add too much meaning to what is ultimately just some photons hitting a piece of celluloid or a piece of silicon?
Well, we are all about meaning. We are about meaning and story. So yes, of course.
But is the meaning actually there, or is it stuff that we're adding to it in order to try to find some importance in our lives?
That's probably a great topic for another show.
All right. Well, we'll discuss it then.
What is the definitive portrait of Harrison Ford?
Yeah.
And is that really him, or is that a publicity shot that he needed to promote, regarding Henry or something?
Yeah, exactly. Good movie,
I don't know.
By the way.
Yeah, it is a good movie. Yeah.
I don't know. We'll discuss it next time. Sorry to lay that on you at the end.
No, that's great, actually. Next week on an all new on Taking Pictures.
All right. Let people go finish their Christmas shopping.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
See you. This way.